It's not simply the fact that there's an empathetic connection with a character that goes through a series of disasters and then overcomes in the end, because that could lead to a very dangerous kind of believe in yourself and it will be fine, which is nonsense. Yes. What you actually learn is that, and this is what all the fairy tales have, is that you can't do it unless you have help from the wild, from the outside, from the ineffable, from the crazy.
The Commonplace is a podcast for the new homeschooling mom delighted by the ideals and principles of a classical Charlotte Mason education, but who feels unsure of how to get started on the practical side of nourishing a soul on the good, the true, and the beautiful. I hope you find camaraderie here as we get our bearings in the world of old ideas and old books, of wisdom and virtue, and of the means of grace by which God works in this world through the commonplaces, which includes your home. So, if you're like me, trying to offer your children an education unlike your own, and wondering if you can create an atmosphere, a discipline, and a life of such richness, I'm here to tell you, I think you can. I'm your host, Autumn Kern, and I'm pleased to welcome you to The Commonplace. Welcome back to The Commonplace. My name is Autumn, and we are continuing our fourth season all about story. And today, our special guest is Deacon Nicholas Kotar. Will you say hello to The Commonplace?
Hello, everybody. Good to be here.
I'm really excited about this. I've been introducing each guest with how I came across their work. And so we need to give a shout out to your sister, who left a YouTube comment for me and said, "You must look at my brother's work. You would really love it." And I did. I found your interview with Matt Frad of Pints with Aquinas and listened to the whole 3-hour thing. It was delightful. Wow. It was really wonderful. I'm going to link it in today's episode notes in case anyone wants to listen to you speak on this further. But it led me to your website, and you shared a bit about your childhood. And this is when I knew I needed to read more, because you used to stand outside in the backyard yelling at clouds that looked like Aslan.
That's right.
What my children do on the regular. So I knew that I had to become more familiar with your work, and fairy tales is kind of your thing. So if you would please tell The Commonplace a bit about your work and how you came through the classical wardrobe to kick us off.
Sure. My work, it would take a while. I don't want to just focus on the first question, but I write fairy tales. I write epic fantasy inspired by fairy tales, specifically Russian fairy tales. And that's something that I've been doing for years now. And more recently, I've started to delve into the fairy tales themselves and started to tell them without the lens of epic fantasy. So I started out kind of trying to be the Tolkien for the Russian world, but in English. That's a whole different conversation that I've actually had with people, but never mind. And now I'm doing more and more work with the stories themselves, which I'm finding to be very exciting. As for how we got through the classical wardrobe, my parents opened up a K-12 classical Orthodox school in 1994. It was one of the first of its kind in the U.S., and they were involved in the early days of classical education, talking to all the people, going to all the conferences. And after I finished that school, there's a story about how that school started. We can talk about that if you want. But I ended up coming back as a teacher and teaching there for 7 years. So classical education is something that was baked in from the very beginning to just how we were raised. And it's also that setting, the setting of the school itself, was a huge inspiration to me as a writer and a thinker, and just as somebody who approaches culture from a certain direction. So that's the short version of the answer.
I would actually love to hear about how that school started, because that's part also on your bio, that your mom decided to stop herding cats and just opening a classical school would be easier than homeschooling you guys. Yes. And I know a couple of moms that could easily make that jump as well. So if you don't mind sharing, I would actually love to hear about it.
Yeah. So we come from Russian stock, and we were raised in such a way as to preserve both of our cultures and our languages. In fact, when we were kids, it was common to hear the parents or the adults talking about basically we're living on suitcases. And in all seriousness, the idea that someday we'd all return to a newly resurgent Tsarist Russia was a real consideration amongst the people that I grew up with. So I didn't speak English, even though I was born in San Francisco. I didn't speak English until I was 4 or 5. And that was entirely on purpose. And it didn't affect my ability to learn English. It did affect my ability to retain Russian. So that being the case, it meant schooling was probably going to be difficult anyway, because as school age, we didn't really speak English, not very well. Plus, this was not as bad as things are right now, but my parents were always careful about the influence of the wider world. We lived in a kind of a ghetto in San Francisco. It was a place where basically you could get by not speaking any English at all. If you knew Russian and you knew Chinese, I didn't, but I knew Russian, you could get by. There was enough stores, enough pharmacies, enough restaurants that you could literally not speak English and you'd be perfectly okay. And it felt like the outside world was something to be kept at bay, a kind of positive version of the buffer itself, a la Charles Taylor, but in a good way. So that's where I think the decision came to homeschool us. Plus, my mom was very intelligent, very well read, very very good at teaching. So she was able to give us a lot more than we would have gotten in any other situation. But as the story goes, you alluded to it. My sister and I have a lot of personality, and there's only two of us. I have four, so I can't even imagine what it would have been like. But we would go outside and yell at clouds shaped like Aslan. And that was far, far too much fun and way more fun than sitting and being taught by one's mother.
Of course.
Yes. So at some point, my mother, as she tells the story, decided that she had had enough of forcing us to sit in one place and study. And then she adds, you know, as if in parentheses, really, they were already smarter than I was, which is nonsense, but whatever. And so she decided, yeah, I'm going to start a school. But that's kind of the fairy tale version, which, of course, is very true. But if you want the full, more historical version, that's that there was just, it was a moment in the community that there was a group of parents with children of a certain age who recognized the need to pool resources and help each other out, because homeschooling is hard, as you know. Mm-hmm. And it was right around the time when there was a big spiritual event in our community. I can talk a little bit about that if you want, but it's the San Francisco had a very impressive and very saintly bishop in the 60s who was a remarkable man. And he was only here for a short period of time, but his life is filled with the kind of both cultural building and just humanitarian drive that you find in the most famous saints. He would, you know, gather orphans off the streets in China and take them into his home and raise them. And some of them ended up traveling with him to San Francisco in their old age, and some of them are still alive. He would give away his shoes to people if they didn't have shoes, you know, things like this. But he died and was buried in San Francisco. And San Francisco is an odd place because it's so damp. You're actually not allowed to bury people inside the city limits. There's a city outside of San Francisco that's almost entirely dedicated to the dead. It's a city called Colma, and it's casually known as the cemetery city. Almost the entire space is occupied by the dead. But he received, or rather the parish received, special permission from the city to bury him in a specially prepared sarcophagus in the basement of the church. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a point to all this.
No, I believe it.
The point was that in the Orthodox tradition, as in the Catholic, it is sometimes not infrequent for men and women of saintly life to leave incorrupt relics. And in the setting of San Francisco, that's extremely unlikely, considering that it is so damp and he was buried above ground. So there was this moment where the bishop and my father, who was a priest in the parish, with special permission from their bishop, went into that space in order to find out whether or not there was anything left. There was a movement to canonize him. So they went down into the sepulcher in the middle of the night because it was illegal to have dead bodies in the city of San Francisco, much less open up sarcophagi with a body that's been dead for 30 years at that point. And they uncovered it, and his body was incorrupt and incredibly well preserved, including hair and nails, which is for context, the sarcophagus itself was rotted through. The coffin was barely in one piece. It was falling off its hinges, and it was rusted through. Exactly the kind of situation where you don't expect any human remains to be there, but completely incorrupt, nails, hair, the works. And there was a big event following this, an official recognition of his status as saint. 5,000 people showed up to the church, which can hold about 400. So an entire city block was closed off. It was a huge event. They basically paraded his remains around city blocks inside San Francisco. Like it was on the news. It was a big deal. But on the tail end of that, this group of parents decided they would take advantage of a new saint and ask his help to start a school in his name. And because my mother knew him as a child, she was here in San Francisco when he was the bishop, and she remembers him personally. So they decided to open the school, and that's where the soil, it was very rich, because it was not just people who were very committed, small group, 15 students in the beginning, but also it was very actively, there was active intercession all the time. It was a normal thing for a teacher to suddenly have to leave the employ of the school at the very possible last minute because of some family disaster. And literally the next day, somebody show up at the door saying, "I'd like to be a teacher." This happened repeatedly. Financial worries were a constant, ever-present cloud, but the money would come in at the very last second every single time. And this was the atmosphere in which I grew up. It wasn't just the ferment of intellectual discourse. It was also the reality of life being pierced through with presence, with ineffability from something just outside of what you can see, which I think is a very important aspect of classical education, to recognize the fact that what you see and what you experience is just part of the reality. If you want to talk about Plato's cave, fine, but this is even more immediate. And in some sense, fairy tales express that reality in a very beautiful way, because they have mundane, regular, everyday things in them, but there's these forces, these powers that come in and do randomly bizarre things. And that part of it is actually very reflective of real life if you live in that kind of frame, which is what we did. So for me, reading those fairy tales as an adult, I'm like, yeah, this is actually more of what real life actually is like than in some cases realistic fiction is. So
absolutely, that's a tremendous story. Thank you for sharing that. I was not aware of all of that backstory, obviously, from your bio online. That's a wonderful story, and it touches on so many threads that I want to pull in this conversation. So listener, if you've not picked up yet, Deacon Nicholas is here to talk about fairy tales. That is very specifically why he is here. And in this season, we are looking at a lot of different parts of story, because moms have a lot of questions when they come in through what I call the wardrobe, because all of a sudden, we're not supposed to see the world the same way. We don't want this modern view anymore. We want to take on this pre-modern approach. We want to see a whole child. We want to see a whole life. And fairy tales could honestly be their own season. We have so many questions about fairy tales. And so I'm really glad you're here today to help us out with some of it. But just getting started, for our literary genre's sake, can you tell us what makes a story a fairy tale?
Yeah, it's hard to define. I mean, I've heard that question asked in many different ways. One of the more popular ones is, what's the difference between a myth and a fairy tale? But I'm just going to be very specific, and I'll just explain to you what a Russian fairy tale is. I'm not going to go broad, but a Russian fairy tale is a story set in a semi-mythical version of real life, where there are stock characters and archetypes that act out certain repeated patterns over and over again. And there is a movement from the beginning to the end that is frequently also repeated from story to story, in which the entire drama of life is encapsulated as in an egg. And that's looking at the story just directly as story. But the truth of it is what the fairy tales are, according to the thought of a wonderful Russian philosopher named Ivan Ilyin. who unfortunately doesn't have a very popular standing in the culture right now for various reasons. But he has a wonderful essay called The Spiritual Meaning of Stories. And his assertion, which I think is absolutely correct, is that fairy tales in the Russian historical context are the physical manifestation of the Christianization of the common people of Russia over the course of 1,000 years. So what does that mean for the larger fairy tale genre? Fairy tales are that. They are the soul of a people expressed in archetypal patterns, but not merely as pattern, but as story. So the pattern and the story intertwine, the history is there, the desires of the people are there, and it's very, very specific to each place where you are, but I think you can say that of all fairy tales is that they reflect most the soul of the people from which those story came, from which those stories came.
Okay, yes, that's wonderful. I think one thing is I've entered the fairy tale world with my children, not something I grew up in, but something I'm learning to do with them, is that when you do kind of step back, there is that everyman quality to them.
Yes.
In that when you look at your basic parts of the story, it could happen with a common name, like a Jack. I'm thinking of our fairy tales. They're more like a Jack.
Yep.
Or they're in a common place at a common time. And I think that's really important because it adds the lasting power that the form is something shared across time and place. And so when we think about historical memory, passing things down, one thing that we've talked a lot about at the commonplace is giving our children a vertical inheritance, something you're passing down rather than a horizontal child culture. Something that only appeals to children. Mm-hmm. And so when you think about sharing this historical memory, why is it important for children to inherit these stories?
Well, it's both. It's both the vertical and the horizontal. On the one hand, these are stories that are understandable because they're so simple. Mm-hmm. But there's something more profound in it. And so I think actually the children can teach us this even more than we can teach them. The fact that the truths are transmitted not through a didactic means, but by means of dreams and by means of rhythms and by means of repeated language patterns, the kinds of things that children do naturally, the way they learn naturally. So because these stories inhabit the same kind of world as childhood, they're able to infuse that childhood with meaning that is reflected back across centuries. And the older the story is, the more archetypal it tends to be, the easier it is to understand, the simpler it is. And very often, the fewer kind of personal motivations you find amongst the characters. The characters are almost moving through a space without even thinking somehow, like as if moved by cosmic powers, which is really how children experience the world in a lot of ways. So it's quite natural for them to hear those stories. But the older the stories are, if they've endured all the way to this moment, that's not by accident, because there is a filtering mechanism that happens naturally through culture. If the story isn't good, if it doesn't have a truly deep meaning that both an adult and a child can inhabit, then it will simply be sloughed off. And you can see that there's in these collections of shorts of fairy tales that you can find, both in the European settings and in the Russian, where these effectively these preservers of culture in the 19th century would go out into the deeps, go into the villages in the far reaches of their country, and write down what is an orally transmitted culture. Very often you would find stories in those collections that nobody really repeated, that were simply part of the repertoire but weren't really spoken. So they would write them all down because they wanted to know everything. But the ones that ended up resonating the most, the ones that had the most repeated patterns, the ones that were most similar from place to place to place, those are the ones that are the oldest. And so they're the ones that have probably the most important things to say to us, simply because they've survived as long as they have. So there's something about the format, the way that the story is told itself, that teaches a child, and it can also teach an adult. But the trick is to turn your brain off.
Ah, do you want to say more to that?
Yeah, because the problem is that this may seem strange to many parents who read fairy tales to their children, because the fairy tale tradition that we've received in the West has been redacted and filtered out and titrated and redone through a period of several hundred years, you know, starting with the collections of Charles Perrault and down into the Grimms, etc. There was a movement, especially after Enlightenment, to to remove any objectionable material, whatever that means, because we can talk about that later. But most children don't really respond to the quote objectionable material the way that adults do. But there was also, because of the Enlightenment's desire to put everything into a perfect glass container and then leave it there to die, we wanted our tidy little morals at the end of the tales so that we could then pass on the important thing to the child. Not surprisingly, there was a study made by somebody who has no skin in the game. This is a Darwinian evolutionist, a guy named Angus McFadden, wonderful name, who did this really cool study. He has said publicly that he can't explain his proprietary method, so we kind of have to trust him that it works. But it involves fMRI machines and scanning children's brains and being able to determine like the activity of pleasure centers and things like this, right? Which generally I'm kind of like, this is not what we're talking about, but fine, let's go with it for the purposes of argument. And he's actually demonstrated that children enjoy, simply based on brain scans, stories that don't have morals at the end. And the ones that have morals, they tend to tune out. So in the West, you have this tradition of fairy tales that are very rationalized. Mm-hmm. And they've come to us in these perfect little jewels. And those jewels are only perfect for the parents. And you give them to the children. The children are like, that's great. Lovely. Give me the Disney version. And give me the toys, right? Oops, we've missed something here. Well, if you go into the Russian tradition, which hasn't had its enlightenment at all, because those stories, they remained with the common people, and any kind of Renaissance or post-Renaissance movement was only in the elite culture, which had no connection to the stories whatsoever. And the folk kept their stories all the way to the 20th century. You listen to these stories, they're wild, they're mad. There's all kinds of chaos, there's violence, there's, you know, princes being chopped into pieces by their brothers. I mean, it's mad. And if you approach it with a purely rationalistic perspective, you are going to say, what possible good can my child receive from this violence? This is simply an expression of a crazy Russian country that's had violence in its history. I don't want my child to have anything to do with this.
Right.
But you'd be wrong.
Mm-hmm. No, you've touched on so many things. I've noticed that when I can note that a fairy tale is probably a really good one is when my children understand it and they take it into their play usually.
Yep.
When I sit around and I'm trying to figure out what exactly is going on and making sure that it's somehow scrubbed well enough for children, that's usually when I notice my kids are not paying attention halfway through. Yep. The story never comes out in their play. I don't hear any references to it. But I think that's something in the power of fairy tale is that it's really easy to see the virtue and the vice. Like there's not this moral ambiguity when the story is actually told really well, even though to a quick read for a modern parent, you think, this is messy. I can't do this. And that's actually one question I wanted to throw at you, and you've kind of already teed up for it, is that I know more than a couple of moms who have picked up fairy tales to read before bedtime, and they start reading and they choke on the words. Like I cannot read something so dark to my children as they fall asleep or any time of day, and they're rewriting it on the fly because they just weren't prepared for perhaps what was coming. Yeah. What do you say to the mom listening who's hesitant to read fairy tales because they're kind of wild and a little terrifying sometimes?
Yeah, a lot terrifying sometimes. Yeah. I mean, it's a perfectly natural response. I found myself doing that sometimes, and even though I've grown up with these fairy tales, I have to force myself to read them the way they are. There's something about the transmission of the fairy tales in the form that they were given, not in the form that they were written down in the 19th century, but in the form that they came through the oral tradition. And there are ways of getting to the older versions of these tales. The Grimms actually were very good about finding originally spoken tales and not really changing them much. Charles Perrault was not. He was all about scrubbing it. So there, you have to be careful about who you're looking at. And of course, there were the Grimm versions that were then themselves scrubbed, not by the Grimms, but by others, right? But there's something to say, first of all, about the fact that these stories were preserved for as long as they were in the forms that are as dark and as violent and as strange and as apparently morally ambiguous as they are. So just stopping and being in the presence of this thing and embracing the mystery of the fact that something so strange persisted throughout the centuries is something that everybody should do, because it's a very healthy thing to stand in front of a mysterious phenomenon and not try to come up with an answer why. Just simply be in the mystery and say, this is.
Yeah.
So how am I then going to relate to it is the next question. Not how am I going to explain it away, but how will I relate to it? Because the fact is that the inability to say those things to the children has less to do with the children than has to do with the parent. There's something mm-hmm. about those things that is disturbing to the parent for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes it's a lack of trauma that does it, not actual trauma. So mm-hmm. it's oftentimes the scrubbed Western suffering-free life that we have that presents to us the mere suggestion of real lived trauma as something that must be avoided, which is a very dangerous thing to do. And it's also reflective of the fact that, unfortunately, in the West, which has lost its connection with the ancient ascetic traditions of both East and West, the monastic traditions, America doesn't have a monastic tradition, not really.
Right.
If you don't have that, you don't understand that there is a reality to life suffering that one must simply sometimes embrace and not run away from. And in fact, sometimes it means actively cultivating that kind of strenuosity or pain, not, you know, mm-hmm. self-flagellation or anything like that. But, mm-hmm. you know, in this recent men's movement, there is this kind of men nowadays go out and do different difficult and painful things. Why? Because they recognize that the absence of physical stress and pain in their life is causing them suffering much more than the presence of it. And by trying to avoid any mention of it to our children, what we're doing is we're not giving them the heart framework to be able to walk through suffering when it comes. Mm-hmm. Because the point is children suffer. They suffer a lot because they're going through extremely difficult epochal changes constantly. Why mm-hmm. why do we have terrible twos, terrible fours? It's because for them, these are cosmic shifts in consciousness, in existence. They really are. Mm-hmm. And these stories help the children inhabit similar rhythms, but also allow them to see that going through those things and suffering with the character is what mm-hmm. allows you to get out through the other end. And it's not simply the fact that there's an empathetic connection with a character that goes through a series of disasters and then overcomes in the end, because that could lead to a very dangerous kind of believe in yourself and it will be fine, which is nonsense. Yes. What you actually learn is that, and this is what all the fairy tales have, is that you can't do it unless you have help from the wild, from the outside, from the ineffable, from the crazy, from mm-hmm. the chaotic. And kids love that because they know that they're not good. They know that they're bad, that they need to strive towards it. They know it. And that's why it's so sad when you see all these parents, you know, coddling their kids. You're fine, you're fine, you're good, you're good. Yes, of course you are. But they in their heart know that they are not what they should be. And they mm-hmm. want to be better. This is just simply what's built into all human beings. It's just a simple fact. And these stories provide us with the strongest kind of architecture to be able to live through that. Because for whatever reason, we are storytelling creatures.
Yeah.
And, you know, created by an artist god who himself inhabited a fairy tale story, the greatest mm-hmm. of them all, and brought it down into history as Tolkien and you know, told to Lewis. So
right.
there's something profoundly dangerous about whitewashing the fairy tales, because this is your best chance for your children to teach your children to just grow the internal architecture to be able to become resilient and to be able to mm-hmm. properly relate to that which is above, that which is beyond what we see. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's no surprise to me that so many people nowadays are materialists. I think it's precisely because they haven't had fairy tales, because they didn't understand as children that their view of the world, the dream state that they were in, is actually much closer to what reality is than what right. we think when we're adults.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that your idea there that you within the fairy tale, or the character within the fairy tale, is not rescued by their own doing, their own intelligence, whatever it is often this outside force, brings up the next question that a mom has, which is, what do I do with all this magic in a fairy tale? And for various reasons, they have a problem with the magic. But in my defense of fairy tales, I usually talk about it like it's something that looks a lot like grace to me. Mm-hmm. It's usually unexpected. It's usually undeserved. And it works in really mysterious, healing ways in a story. So can you tell us then, kind of jumping off this last one, but why is magic necessary to the fairy tale and to a child's understanding of reality as it is?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've already answered it, in large part by using the word grace. It's a very good word, and it's one that's tragically misused in the English language. When people say giving each other grace, is actually not the meaning of the word, and it's unfortunate because there is something about grace being from outside the veil, kind of piercing through, that is very important and is missed in that common usage of that word. But what I would say is this. First of all, you have to understand that these stories, this is what I would say to a parent, these stories have persisted in cultures that have had serious problems with actual magic. So in Russia, in Greece, in rural Europe, you always had witches, et cetera, et cetera. This was a never present reality. Okay. And not the fairy tale kind, like actual people who engaged in black magic. This is a historical reality in much of the world. So to think that the church or the cultural elites or the mothers of families would somehow allow for this evil force to slip into stories that are meant for the entire village is strange. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, it's, you have to think about how could that possibly be? Oh, it was the influence of the devil. No, sorry. Like, this is an entire history's worth of cultural development. It doesn't just happen by accident. So there's something there that we're missing if we're looking at it as, oh, magic is dangerous. Because magic was always there. And these stories actually provided for the opposite. People who are raised in stories were raised in stories historically, did not all become necromancers. They all became good members of society for the most part. Of course, you have the occasional odd duck, but you can't avoid that. But so that's the first thing. The second thing is you have to understand that the world of the fairy tale is not the world you see. And this is very beautifully and very effectively transmitted in the oral culture in Russia. By the storyteller. So every storytelling traditionally would not begin with the story. It would begin with something called a pre-story. Unfortunately, I don't have any good ones in my memory banks. I really need to do that, memorize them, but because they're really wild. Basically, the idea is simple. You have this strange, rhythmic, very vivid, often violent, a lot of wordplay, some of it adult in nature, just collection of random stuff that is not connected to the story. And it is so shocking and so odd as people are trying to listen with their rational ears, trying to make sense of the series of images, these series of bizarre, rhythmically structured sentences, that it ends rather abruptly in the middle of some rather odd image. And then we go from there into in a certain kingdom, in a certain land, which is a ritual incantation of sorts that lets you know the story's beginning. But if you were just simply to start in a certain kingdom, in a certain land, there isn't enough of a buffer between real world and world of fairy tale for people to intrinsically realize that the fairy tale is a different space. As a different space, it has its own rules. Now, those rules reflect in very real ways the rules of the real world. The patterns that you see in fairy tales reflect patterns of reality, but at a very deep level and not at the level of the senses. Not at the level of eye, ear, and mouth, but at the level of something beyond them, at the level of the thing that you think you can sense in extremely profound moments of love, of experiencing beauty in nature, something like that. And everybody understands this intrinsically. You go, you're somewhere in a beautiful place, you stop, and suddenly the world opens itself up to you, and you can feel somehow that everything around you is not simply that thing that you see, but even, you know, the waterfall that you're looking at is what is it in this is in C.S. Lewis talks about it. It's not beautiful. It's sublime, right? It's
the sublime. Yeah. The green grammar book.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. There's something beyond it that is simultaneously not there and there. Everybody understands this intrinsically. This experience. Fairy tales are that all the time. Mm-hmm. And so how do you express that? Well, that experience is in the real life is very much like enchantment, very much like things taking on an extra sheen of something magical. So the presence of it, then, of magic, is simply an expression of that ineffable touch of something sublime, something beyond the veil that you experience in beautiful and transcendent moments of your life. But it's happening all the time, which is really how we should live. We should be in the presence of this all the time. And in the fairy tale, you're allowed to do that. And that's why things are never orderly. That's why they're always chaotic, because that's how it works. The orderliness is an imposed thing by a humanity that is trying to make sense of a very chaotic and fallen world that they've found themselves in. This is what we're supposed to do. We are created in an image of a harmonizer. So we must harmonize. But ironically, the best way to harmonize is not to do it rationally, but to do it through the heart. And the fairy tales do that. But they do that as a kind of long-term cultural accumulation. It's not simply the decision of one person, this is going to be a good story, I'm going to have this character. It happens as a people. And as a people, it's like the building of the cathedrals in some sense, right? It's generations of people that come together. And instead of there being an architect, small a, with the plans for a church, there's an architect with a large A that has the plans for the people. And the people express that plan, but at a very deep, very dreamlike level. And you need that, because this is the language that everybody can understand, both child and adult, as long as the adult hasn't closed his eyes.
Yeah, that is wonderful. I have never come across a fairy tale with that pre-read, almost like a bridge into it. Are those just in Russian fairy tales?
I do know they exist in Russian fairy tales. I imagine it's probably something that was present in other oral traditions, but the trick is that it's oral, and it doesn't do well in written form, because it can't happen without the personality of the speaker. So someday I'll just learn a few and
put them online for us.
Yeah,
this leads me to two questions. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. One, I know that a mom who just heard the last two answers surely is thinking, yes, okay, I need fairy tales, lots of them in my home. But you've mentioned the older they are, the better they are. And I know as I came into this world with my kids, trying to track them down, you buy 100 bad collections of fairy tales before you start to figure out by just, reading a couple, oh, this is good, this isn't. How do you recommend that a mom tracks down the best ones?
Yeah.
That's what they're wondering right now.
Yes. And unfortunately, you're not going to like my answer. Because we don't have the accumulation of culture here in America that other old world countries have had, then you mothers and fathers have to do the work of generations in a very short period of time. So it's not going to be pleasant. And yes, you want to have the handbook that says, go and find these. And I will provide you with something. But first, I will say that it is far better for your children and for yourself if you wade through the garbage as you try to find the pearl. Because it's not going to be as precious unless you've gone through the difficulty. And in fact, you'll know that if you've read the stories, because that's what the stories are all about. So you must inhabit the story as you're looking for the story.
Excellent answer. Excellent.
But that being said, I would recommend that you check out Vigen Guroian's wonderful book on the moral imagination, and the title escapes me at the moment, but I'm sure.
It's Tending the Heart of Virtue.
And the second edition, which just came out, has a very reluctant guide at the end in the appendix that tells you some good collections, but it's very, he is doing it while the Russians have an expression, while scratching at his heart. Doesn't want to do it, but he was forced and he does it. So I'd recommend you do both. Suffer a little bit and then look at the list.
And then look at the list. Yes. Okay. Commonplace listeners should be very familiar with Dr. Ruin's book by now. And also, you had a great interview with him, which I will make sure ends up in the episode notes.
Yes, please do. It was lovely.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. So then do you recommend that a mother actually commits fairy tales to heart and tells them orally to her children without the book?
Yes.
Okay. I thought you might.
Yes. But don't. Okay. So here's where my thinking on this has changed. And this is something that's new for me. When I started retelling fairy tales, I probably would have suggested that you just skew as close as you can to the received tradition. In other words, take the Grimm versions and commit them to memory. And I think Dr. Guroian would say do that. The thing is, there is something to be said about inhabiting the story yourself and letting it be spoken through your own heart to your children. There's something about memorizing the story, but not the words to it, so that when you become so comfortable with the rhythms of it that you can tell it to them. And most of that's going to be the same as the memorized type as the published version. But what you will notice is that the kinds of things that tend to come out when you say it and when you're not reading it or reciting it, but actually speaking it, is the stock phrases that are repeated throughout fairy tales. Those are the things that end up coming out. And the interstitial stuff is where you can really add a little bit of your own personality. And there's a back and forth that happens between you and your children when you do this, because their eyes light up at certain things and you lean into that. And it's a really beautiful thing, because at that point it's an act of communal creation, of creativity, of culture building that is not you imposing on the children, but creating in community in a very profound way, as probably it was done for centuries, if not millennia.
Yeah. Okay, that's great. I thought, surely we all need to start learning to orally transmit these stories within our own home. This is definitely an inspiring idea for me. Yeah. Now, one thing that I've heard you talk about before is that when you read a fairy tale, you really need to have a posture of humility. I think this is kind of coming through in what you've said. But I did want to ask you why humility is the soil for understanding and enjoying a fairy tale, particularly for the modern mom coming in and maybe struggling to, as you say, leave her brain off.
Well, because humility is the posture of the sage, of the mystic, of the prophet. So what we're looking for here is insight. We're not looking for insight as in the insight received from outside. We're looking for a prophecy to be revealed. We're not looking for a formula to be solved. And the latter, where you're simply trying to figure out the answer to something, you can do that and most likely will do that from a posture of self-aggrandizement because, oh, I've figured this out. I've come up with the key. And you can't help it, but that will raise you up in the wrong kind of way. And unfortunately, inside the stories, we know what happens to those characters. They get chopped up by their brothers into little pieces.
Right.
The posture of humility is the posture in which you recognize, I don't know the answer. And then you have a conversation with God. And give me the insight to understand what this story is trying to tell me. And you'll find this in all traditions, even non-Christian ones. It's a really remarkable thing to talk to somebody like Martin Shaw, who's one of our greatest storytellers, greatest oral storytellers, who also writes beautifully, who as a formerly essentially a kind of, not kind of, an actual pagan, would have the same kind of posture, but he thought that the insight was coming from the earth, or from the spirits of the earth or something like this. But because he had that posture, when he had an actual experience of divine illumination, as he found out it was later, he was able to make that profound leap from paganism to Christianity because of that posture. Mm-hmm. Because it was a posture of a man on his knees before something not understandable, but so much greater than him. So we're doing the same thing as parents. We're looking for the insight to be able to raise our children into human beings. We can't do that by ourselves. We can't do that by figuring it out. What do we have to go back on? Genetic memory?
Yes. Excellent. Okay. Well, before I let you go here, I have to ask you, thinking back to your childhood when you were yelling at clouds and then to today, can you give us a couple of your personal favorite fairy tales?
My personal favorite fairy tales. Well, I've collected them, my favorites, into the first volume of my collected Russian fairy tales called In a Certain Kingdom, Fairy Tales of Old Rus. There are wonderful tales. They're starting from Prince Ivan and the Firebird, which many people may have heard, to a version of the Frog Princess, to an absolutely bonkers story about a white duck and a witch and shapeshifters and changelings. Check that book out. It's wild.
Absolutely. I will make sure that's linked for everyone. You can go and discover his favorite fairy tales along with your children. Now, as you leave us, Deacon Nicholas, will you please let us know where everyone can find you and what projects you have in the works? Because you have quite a few really exciting ones right now.
Yeah, just today I announced the return in transfigured form of a podcast that I've had for the past few years that used to be called In a Certain Kingdom, where I retold Slavic, not only Russian, but it's wider than that. Fairy tales with beautiful musical accompaniment by a composer named Natalie Wilson. That has been on hiatus for a while. I actually lost my voice. I had a very serious laryngitis for about 6 months last year that forced me to stop doing any sort of voice related work. And as that happened, I had to sort of rejigger my priorities, and I've decided to come back to the stories, but in a new way, telling them less as translations and more as inspired tellings coming from a direct experience of a direct interaction with the story at its core, with music, new music. And that's going to be coming. It's going to be launching later on this month. So, but where can you find out about it? Everything that I do is on my website, nicholaskotar.com. And for the really hardcore people who want the crazy behind the scenes stuff, I do have a Patreon community as well.
And I hear very good things about it. There are, there's a family I know who is a part of it. Oh. And when I went to church one day, I was telling book club that I heard about your work. I asked if anyone knew about you, and I realized I was the only one on the outs. And everyone else was already in on your Patreon and your work, and it was just me who didn't
know. My plan for world domination is working. Yes.
Slowly eking through the parishes. So yes, absolutely. I will link all of that. And like I said, my friends really enjoy the Patreon. So there's another plug.
That's wonderful.
For it.
I'm so glad to hear it.
Deegan Nicholas, thank you so much for joining me today.
Real pleasure, Autumn. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Everyone else, I'll see you in 2 weeks.